And we're live, and we're live, and I'm looking at the light, everyone. I'm looking at the light. I'm not looking at the screen, all right? It's very disconcerting for me. So tonight is a big one. It's a big one for us. So we are chatting live with Mr. Richard Seal from Foursquare Rum Distillery in Barbados, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning. So
in Barbados,
not here. So we hope we've got a good audience. We hope we've got some good questions. But the first thing we're going to do is say a big hello to Richard. Richard, thank you, mate. Glad you've joined us. And a round of applause from the room.
So early.
Thank you.
And Richard, what's in your glass tonight?
You're not
drinking anything, are you?
So 6 a.m. I have neither rum nor cigars. A very unusual podcast for me.
That's a bit of a worry. I was told to watch out if you weren't smoking a cigar, Richard.
All right, let's rip into it, guys. So what are we drinking? Well, as I said, courtesy of Karu Rum. Can you all see that? Yep, you can. Foursquare Rum. So we've been sampling that. Then we are going to move on. Nearly did. To local distillery, very local, Karu Distillery. And rum distiller, Australian rum distiller. And the rum distiller. Then, because it's not 6 o'clock in the morning, we're going to move on to an Australian well-established rum, historical rum. So in a circle. And then as something completely different, just to finish the night, a new iconic release in Australia, not rum. Golden Bicky. Whiskey liqueur. It's got coconut, it's got oats, and it's got golden syrup. So this is Australia. So it's brand spanking new release from a distillery called Ned, and just been released, and we got a bottle and we're cracking that to finish the night off.
Dessert.
That is dessert. All right, so let's rip into it, Richard. So I'll kick off with the first question, and then we'll go to the room and everyone can ask questions. So one thing I would like to ask is, in whiskey world, we talk about the Scotch whiskey, we talk about the American whiskey, we talk about the Japanese whiskey, and we talk about the New World whiskey. And in Australia, we're the New World whiskey. Right, and we're going in many different directions. In rum world, how is rum world globally seen from your perspective?
Well, sorry, I'm getting a bit of feedback from you guys.
You want me to ask that?
You heard your question.
So it's echoing.
So far.
You can hear me okay though.
Yeah, we're working on that issue at the moment.
I'll press on. What I can do is okay. So yeah, that's a good framing. So the rum world is not dissimilar to the whiskey world in the sense of having the older producers. So I wouldn't call it old world and new world, because obviously rum is in the context of new world, but there is the kind of the older producers and the younger producers. And so places like Barbados, Jamaica, Martinique, we're speaking of the older producers, so the 77 producers. And so when you think of rum from these places. These are the ones that have the legacy of, you know, pot stills from the beginning. So, you know, we think of ourselves as very old spirits, like Scotch, well, Irish whiskey, not yet. To give you context, in the mid 17th century, Barbados was exporting more rum than if you added up all of the cognac, all of the Irish whiskey, and all of the Scotch whiskey. So the rum world is sort of divided between the older producers and the newer producers. So the newer producers are the ones that more came on 19th century. And so these are the ones who wouldn't find a long heritage of pot stills. And you wouldn't, you know, most of the producers would date back to, you know, early 20th century, this kind of thing. So I'm obviously thinking Central America, South America, Far East, this kind of thing. So that's kind of how we would split the rum world from the sort of old. So, you know, you go to Barbados, you see pot stills. Why? It's not a choice, because we go back since the 17th century. You go to Jamaica, you see pot stills. Right. So it's a little bit like the division of Scotch whiskey and American whiskey. You know, so American whiskey's all column stills. Why is American whiskey all column stills? Well, okay, and now we have obviously the craft, but I mean the broad industry, and that's because it more or less is born in the early 19th century. And Scotch whiskey, single malt, it's pot stills. Why is it pot stills? Well, because it's, you know, born in the very late 17th, early 18th century. And so you see that same division in rum, where you have these, you know, much older producers from places like Barbados, where, of course, as I say, we are a huge exporter of rum in the 17th century. Whereas, you know, many, many places don't really have any significant other than sort of, you know, bush production until late 19th, early 20th century.
And do you see, from the New World perspective, is there more of a focus on pot, or is it a mix between pot and column? Well, what is the direction overall?
So the older producers, and again, you can see maybe an analog between, if you want to sort of put in the context of whiskey, Jamaica is a little bit like Ireland, sort of didn't adopt the column still until very late. So right up to about the 1960s, you wouldn't find any kind of continuous column still in Jamaica. It was all pot still. Whereas Barbados and from a scale more significantly, Demerara, province of Guyana, adopted column stills from the late 19th century. So you see, you see this difference. So, you know, the turn of the century in Demerara, you would have found three type of sugar estate. You would have found a sugar estate that was exclusively pot stills. You would have found sugar estates that had switched to column stills. And the majority of estates, you would have had both. So one of the differences, though, compared to Scotch whiskey, whereas Scotch whiskey, you have a division between the single malt pot stills, and, you know, in the north, and you have and the grain whiskey column stills in the industrial south. One of the big differences in rum is distillers adopting both. So this is what you see in sugar estates. As I say, in the early part of the 20th century in Demerara, you don't see it in Jamaica, because Jamaica famously stubbornly says pot still only. And then, of course, you see it in Barbados. So in Barbados, by the 1950s, well, let me take you one step back. In the 1850s, Barbados had 158 distilleries, all of which were pot still. By the 1950s, we were down to three distilling entities, and all three had a column still. Only one still had pot stills, but all three had column stills, and one was a mix. and the blend.
Okay. All right. That's good. I'll hand it across to Brad.
All right. These questions are in no particular order. I'm not trying to blend them in or anything, but I just want to ask quickly, Barbados Terroir, right? There's a big thing at the moment with craft. He's a massive terrorist, he calls himself. The terroir of Barbados, is there a flavour or an aroma or something that just screams home to you in Barbados rum? And if you could you perhaps distinguish, like, what distinguishes Barbados rum from, say, other styles of rum, say a Cuban or a Jamaican rum, maybe? So
of course, terroir is an interesting question, and it's how you define it. I would say the style of Barbados rum was more or less developed around the modern style of Barbados rum was developed around the early 20th century. I mean, if you go back far enough, if you go back to sort of early 18th century, you would not find huge differences in the rum making methods between, say, Barbados and Jamaica. But it was a much, much smaller scale, but certainly exists in Martinique. And whereas you sort of come along 200 years later and Barbados, Martinique and Jamaica are very diverse in their rum making methods. But that's just it. It's not just, well, again, it depends how you define terroir. The three different styles of rum coming out of there is not just solely driven by terroir. What's happened, of course, is you had this sort of evolution in methods and preferences and culture, you know, driving the style. And so the modern style of Barbados rum is developed by the early 20th century. And it is driven by the advent of the column still and the presence of lighter rums and the development of the blended Barbados rum. So, yes, I mean, today you have, as I say, anyone can pretty well readily distinguish a Barbados rum, a Jamaica rum, Martinique rum, a Guyana rum, broadly. But the inputs that have brought us to this point, terroir in its narrow definition is only part of it. Terroir in its broader definition, of course, we would define all of those changes, all of those cultural impacts as relevant to the question of terroir.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, I was hoping that I'd be next, but I'm kind of just trying to do this a little bit on the fly. And I guess mine is probably less of a technical question and more of kind of like a candid kind of personal experience question. So your family comes from making rum for a very rich history. When you were learning and everything like that, did you come across any sort of, because for us, it's like it's not very common to even meet a second or a third generation distiller. But as I mentioned before, your family has quite the kind of rich history of it. What was that like growing up, having rum be such this big thing within your family, your culture? Was there any mistakes while you were learning that were, in your opinion, a little bit silly and kind of funny to talk about?
hopefully not. But just to be clear, yes, my family's been involved in the rum business. We take our official starting date as 1926. But we were originally blenders. And again, you can, now this is a great parallel with the blended Scotch whiskey, and it's also a big part of the development of the Barbados style. So Barbados rum, very much like Scotch whiskey, there's a division between distiller and blender. So if we think of Scotch and we think of, you know, Mr. Shivers and Mr. Teacher and Mr. Dewar and Mr. Ballantyne, they were all separate from distilleries, and they bought in rum, bought in their whiskey, and they created their blends. And you can also see this in Jamaica as well. If you think of, you know, why is there a Ray and Nephew and an Appleton? Well, Ray and Nephew is the original merchant blender, and they acquire Appleton Distillery. And then there's, of course, Mr. Fred Myers, who is, again, independent of any distillery. So my great-grandfather much like those original Scottish names, of course, on a much, much tinier scale. They're originally, again, like Scotch whisky, they're wholesalers, they're grocers, they're you know, they're merchant traders, and they buy, you know, bulk spirit and blend. And my great-grandfather was one, and one of the brands that we export to Australia, Dorley's, is Martin Dorley. That was a contemporary of my great-grandfather. So I was always raised that I was going to join the business, but what my role in rum might have been could have been very different. But in the 90s, we acquired Foursquare, which was a closed sugar estate, hadn't made rum in more than 100 years. And it was had been closed for a few years as a sugar factory. And we resurrected it and started distilling again. And basically, I joined the business. And I joined at a time where we had these strategic decisions. We had just acquired the Martin Dorley brand. And it was just a question of joining at the right time whereas I had always been involved in the rum, but it was at a particular point that the rum became infinitely more important. Sometimes I look back. Yeah, of course, you know, you're always learning. And sometimes I look back and think, well, thank goodness I made that decision. I don't know why I did. It just lucked in. I mean, at the time, for example, when we did Foursquare, the style of rum had become very light. The style of rums that were very attractive, Bacardi was, you know, very dominant. And when we were putting in things like, you know, my very traditional tin column continuous still, people looked at that at the time and said, well, that's crazy. That's not the style of rum people want today. And of course, when, you know, we also put side by side our classic double retort pot still, and people were just, well, you know, are you stupid? I mean, no one drinks that anymore. No one buys that. So sometimes I look back and I think, how was I so stubborn as to do those things? So sometimes I look back more fondly rather than, but there are things that we look back and I think, yeah, I didn't really have much of a clue then too. I also look back as well, you know, when I say to you, we bought an old closed sugar estate. I mean, the place was in a mess. And, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, if I wasn't sort of young and stupid enough, I might not have taken that risk of resurrecting this old estate that was in terrible shape and had all the old sugar equipment. So I think I look back sometimes and with some of my young, stupid decisions as being fortuitous.
Love it. Thank you very much.
I'm just going to chime in on the question that's been asked, and I'd just like to add to that question. So the question on the board is, any advice for any new makers on fermentation yeast, quantities of dunder, et cetera? What I'd like to add to that is, so I've been making whiskey for 9 years. I started as an indie bottler, been distilling for 7 years. And I've found over the years that I've had to unpick some of my learnings. And one of the things that I've had to unpick is fermentation and the importance of fermentation and how many flavor levers you're playing with at a ferment stage. And yes, distilling is important, and yes, the barrel's important. So taking that question and my comments and my experience, what's your take on fermentations and that?
So this is a little... This is good. This is also a good follow-up from the last question. So at Foursquare, we have two areas of fermentation. One area to the south is molasses, and we call that modern fermentation because it's molasses and it's added yeast. So, you know, it's a sort of, depending on what you're counting, but main body of fermentation of 44 hours. We propagate yeast before that, and then we rest after that. But you'd recognize it as modern fermentation, add yeast, cooling, the rest of it. Then in the north of the Foursquare Distillery, we have our cane juice fermentation. And that is 100% natural fermentation. So this is methods that have been in place, you know, hundreds of years. But I love to describe it a little bit that we are a bit schizophrenic. So literally, much of the principles that we adhere strictly to in the south, we completely abandon and have an opposite philosophy in the north. And I also like to put it in context that when I started to do cane juice fermentations and natural fermentations, I did think by that time that I knew a little bit about fermentation. And then when I started doing natural fermentation, I realized I knew fuck all about actual fermentation. Because, of course, the added yeast fermentation and modern, you know, had become, you know, I don't want to, you know, be derisive, but I mean, it's a little more formulaic. So obviously we're using these added yeast because we get, you know, it's much more predictable and consistent and all the rest of it. And then you start dealing with natural fermentations and you really then realize, well, yes, I have to do a lot more learning. Yeah, I mean, I hope that sort of answers the question. To someone starting out, I would stay, keep it simple, because I think today, because of all these trendy terms of dunder and things like that, I think there is a temptation to make life very complicated and to try to learn a lot of things at the same time. Whereas, I mean, as I say, even myself, 20 years in, I thought I knew something about fermentation, and then I had to do a lot of unlearning. And I still, as I say, I still describe us as a little bit schizophrenic, because you literally have to have two different philosophies in the two different areas, and be thinking in very different ways in for their very different objectives. So for anyone starting out, I would say try not to get overwhelmed with the complexity of it, and try to keep things simple and try to do what you want to do, and not try to read up on every possible direction. For example, we do natural fermentation. We do what you would call traditionally high ester rums, but we don't use dunder. We don't use cane vinegar, we don't use muck, we don't use any of these all things that are very trendy today, because everybody sort of, you know, as they say, hears these things and jumps on these things. We don't use any of those things.
So from that philosophy then to consumer education, how important then is consumer education? And what do you want rum enthusiasts to understand better about rum production, Richard?
That's a good question, because, of course, it's, you know, it's in context. I mean, it's all about your audience. So obviously, when you're speaking to someone like us, I mean, our audience in the grand scheme of things are, you know, is tiny and enthusiastic and generally with a high knowledge. So, of course, the level of conversation I would have with a sort of typical person in my audience would be, you know, it wouldn't be the same thing as, you know, Johnny Walker would have with his, you know, Black Label drinker, you know, or Jack Daniels with their drink, you know, their whole approach. So, you know, our education does tend to be a little more intense, because that's what our customer wants. What the objective is with our type of education is to sort of enhance your experience with the product. So the idea, really, the ultimate idea, is not to turn you, the consumer, into a rum distiller or a rum expert. Of course, that's if you know, you're welcome to go that direction. The real objective is that when you're opening that bottle and having that glass, that I've enhanced your experience, that I've made it more enjoyable because you understand and appreciate the context behind it.
Yep, look, I And I agree with you too. I come from a background of not distilling, but from selling the product, both rums and single malt whiskies. I've been in single malt whiskey for 20 odd years. It's just interesting, like you say, it's picking your audience as to, but I think on as far as labeling goes and the transparency in labeling in rum, what do you think? I mean, I guess maybe
That's a perfect lead on from that question, because the principle is the same. You know, often I'm lumbered with this sort of reputation of transparency, and I actually hate it, because I always explain in the spirits business, we want a little mystery. I don't want to tell you every secret. Part of why people have an enthusiasm about, you know, enjoying, you know, a nice rum or a fine cigar is it's a little bit of the mystery and the art behind it. So I've never been one who wants to, you know, have a label that's sort of a laundry list of specifications. Especially, you know, if I'm someone and I'm just given this laundry list of specs and parameters, 90% of them will be probably misunderstood anyway. I've always found it amusing sometimes to be at rum shows and, you know, the people are very enthusiastic and you have to appreciate their enthusiasm, but sometimes we'll come on and people will be asking me this huge list of everything from, you know, what is your fermentation strength to your distillation strength and what did you go in the barrel at, and, you know, every single possible parameter. And if I don't even understand how some the importance of some of these or how they influence them, you know, how is the consumer? But again, I don't want to reduce rums to this kind of a laundry list. And so what I try to do with a label, again, to the exact point I just said, I just want to enhance that experience. So I want to give you enough information on that label so that when you're enjoying the rum, I've added to it. I actually had this chat with Serge Valentin just at Whiskey Show, because he was sort of saying, why do you put all this information? And I actually had this very same conversation, because he was saying, well, why do you even bother to put the age statement? I said, well, you know, I said, one of the reasons of the age statement too is value. So I always like to say there's sort of three objectives with a label. One, to tell you what the product is. And so this is where something very, now that sounds obvious, but I'm talking about those people who sell, you know, a rum liqueur and sort of passing off as a rum. So I want to tell you it's rum. And that has a very precise meaning. And then the second thing I want to do is to, as I say, enhance, give you the information that helps enhance that drinking experience. And then the other bit of information that's relevant is, of course, the information that's relevant to price. So if I'm selling a rum very cheaply, you probably don't, you know, you probably couldn't care what the age is. But if I'm selling an expensive rum, I feel obligated to tell you how old it is.
Okay. Quick question I've got, and this is coming at it from a completely different angle. So you have two complete strangers, you put them on a table in a social environment, and you put a bottle of whiskey. Odds are on, a conversation will take place and enjoyment will follow. You do the same with a bottle of gin. Odds on, they could still remain strangers. It's a different sort of relationship than whiskey. What's the relationship from that sort of framing with rum when you put two strangers together with a bottle of rum? How do you perceive that?
I can only tell you that one of my experiences is, as someone who does a lot of masterclasses and does masterclasses aimed at the enthusiast with a lot of education, I keep the tasting right to the end. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. Because once you start putting rum in people's, you know, they start tasting, there's a whole buzz that then starts in front of you as everyone starts to loosen up and chat. So my experience is that putting rum in front of people leads to a very happy and talkative time.
All right, well, you want to have any more questions?
Oh, I probably have like 1,000, but I thought it was
12. Go for it. Stop. Well, it's free for.
Another one from Ben.
Okay. Without giving away secrets, do you have any advice on yeast selection for new makers? Does, it was pronounced as wrong, Laman, own the space, or are we better off focusing on quality we can control?
It's a great question. And yeah, unfortunately, Laman does own the space. I used to use a yeast they didn't own, and then they bought the company. So there we go. No, it's a good question, because I'll give you a little sort of framework of it. You know, very often whiskey enthusiasts, and I'm sure you guys would appreciate this, you know, you'd sort of visit an American whiskey distiller, and the American whiskey distiller would, you know, stress the absolute importance of yeast. And then you sort of go to Scotland and, you get the opposite. You know, you sort of ask the question about yeast. Well, what's yeast? Who cares about yeast? And the relevance, though, is that neither are wrong. It's all about what your sort of distilling culture. So, you know, if you're American bourbon distiller and you're working with, you know, one kind of still, you're working with, you know, one kind of wood, yeast is magic for you. It's another lever for you to operate. Rum, like Scotch whiskey, you go to rum and Scotch whiskey, you know, we're blending different stills. We're using a myriad of different woods, French oak, American oak, you know, myriad of seasonings. We're aging really long in the context of sort of typical American whiskey. And so, yeah. Guess what? We didn't get that very excited about yeast. Of course, things are a little different now. People are obviously looking for new ways. And our attitude is very much yeast, meh, on the south side. And the reason for this is not that yeast is not important. Yeast is very important, but it's not the lever on which we turn. And again, everything's a little bit in context, because the relevance of yeast is a little bit different in every spirit. You know, in rum, where there's so much bacteria-driven flavor, yeast is not as important. Still important. But again, as I say, if you go on our south side, our modern side, where we add yeast, you know, we've been using the same yeast strain for the last 25 years. Do I get very excited about my yeast strain? Do I talk about it? In fact, many, because it was very trendy, maybe still is, to talk about a distiller having, you know, we have our own selected yeast strain. Many people would visit me and they would say, well, do you have your own specially cultured yeast strain? I said, no. In fact, the yeast strain I use, once upon a time, there were only about four or five strains used in Scotland. And the one I use is one of those five. I think there's much more now, but going back far enough, there's only about four or five. And so, yeah, on the south side, we don't really give a shit about yeast. But again, it's culture. As I say, the Scotch whiskey guy who doesn't give a shit about yeast, he's not wrong. And the American whiskey guy, I mean, I went to Four Roses Distillery, they use four different strains. Of course, that's vital because it's one of their critical levers. Of course, if you visit me in the north, where we're using natural, you know, we're not adding any yeast, and we know how much the yeast affects us. We know the yeast affects us from March to April. We know the yeast affects us from one year to the next. And we're not talking just about a strain, but several strains of a couple different species. And now we are talking about Saccharomyces versus Schizosaccharomyces. And suddenly yeast is the whole world. That's why I say we're a little bit schizophrenic. Now, again, we're not selecting any yeast. This is all the cards that are dealt to us. But yes, yeast becomes critical. So again, my advice would be not to get too bogged down in it. Keep things simple. Select a strain you like. Don't try to keep turning every knob in your distillery. as I say, I didn't turn that yeast knob. I still haven't turned that yeast knob on the molasses side of the distillery. It's not worth the effort because we have so much other ways of operating. I mean, we make, you know, we have different stills. I have three different stills. We use different woods. We age different times. I mean, there's so much. So again, I mean, for me, when you're dealing with something very complex, which is, you know, the world of fermentation and distillation, as much as you can keep things simplified. And as my friend Gregory from Nissan said, the most, you know, he said, I make the rums I like. That's it. He doesn't obsess about trying to, you know, make some trend or, you know, chase some flavor. You know, he says, I make the rums I like. And that's our philosophy as well. I make the rums. So, you know, any new distiller, make the rum or whiskey you like.
So it's not such a case of what can the yeast do for us, but what can we do for the yeast, do you think?
Or, yeah, well, no, what can the yeast do for us? And maybe in your context, it's not that big a deal. And maybe it is. It all depends. Again, I'm not a whiskey maker, so I can, you know, as I said, that's an important part to understand, that the balance in a fermentation, as famous Jamaican chemist Charles Allen put it. He said, basically, you can set up conditions that either favor the yeast or favor the bacteria. He said, you have to set up conditions to favor the yeast because you need to make alcohol. And if you don't make alcohol, you go bust. But he says, you either set up a fermentation that you favor the yeast or you favor the bacteria, or you can. But the real challenge is to strike that sort of middle ground. So, you know, you have to choose a path. And as they say, in rum, the bacteria is a big part of our flavor. Again, that balance may be different in other spirits. I don't, you know, one of the differences, you know, one of the marvelous things for many small craft distillers is they try their hands at lots of things. I only know about rum. I don't try my hand at anything else.
So my comment just then, I was just going to talk about the bacteria side of it. Because from a whiskey standpoint, bacteria is something, yes, that, yeah, we do consider that. But by the sounds of it, in rum production, bacteria is a major component in making rum. Can you just give us sort of a very short, snap description on how you apply the bacteria? How is it factored in into production?
So, I mean, it's there. And when you're dealing with something like molasses, it's, you know, semi-sterile. You know, it's come through a heating process, but you can waken those bacteria up. And this is why we also have this very important resting period. And then in that resting period, you've got, you know, yeast autolysis, also helping develop flavors. So as I say, in my south side, we would have what we would call, you know, the balance would be very much on the yeast. So what's happening there is we're pitching yeast. It's all Saccharomyces cerevisiae, so it's very efficient. It produces high alcohol. That high alcohol sterilizes. So again, as I say, modern fermentation, you're looking at fermentation very similar to, you know, across the board. So the role of the bacteria is relatively small in context, but maybe higher than in Scotch whiskey. In Scotch whiskey, they tend to, again, I'm not usually familiar, but when I read a little bit about the ones who have a bit of more resting period, and they tend to more develop lactic acid bacteria rather than the wonderful sort of myriad of fatty acids that we develop. I'm not sure quite why. So we develop a nice range of different acid precursors to esters. And so even our modern fermentation would develop a higher level of esters than the typical Scotch whiskey distillery. But then on the natural fermentation side now, the bacteria is king. This is what's developing the flavor. So when we have these natural fermentations, what is happening, yes, you have natural Saccharomyces yeast in the initial stages. They're very efficient, you know, not as efficient as your modern, you know, purchased pitch yeast, but they're pretty efficient. Your natural fermentation starts off very quickly, but it is got a more symbiotic relationship with the bacteria in there than your modern yeast. So your acidity rises, which is fine because you want to produce all these acids. And then what happens, though, eventually is everything quits because the Saccharomyces can't take the acidity. And that's where you have this other magical yeast, the Schizosaccharomyces. And watching natural fermentations can be quite amusing. They race along. Then they come to a grinding halt because Schizosaccharomyces takes its sweet time to grow. And then it kicks in. And what you thought was a dead fermentation kicks on, but it goes very, very, very slowly compared to Saccharomyces. And so you continue to get good development of acidity. You get esterification already taking place. You get these wonderful aromas. And you hit that holy grail, or you try, where you get a good alcohol yield and a magnificent level of flavor because you've had great development of acidity and a good array of fatty acids and good esterification. Underappreciated a little bit is how much the double retort plays in this game in getting the esterification, because there's always a huge, actually I was going to make a little post on this, there's always a huge gap between the theoretical amount of esters that could be made in the fermentation and the actual amount of esters. But again, yeah, it's, you know, the flavor is 90% bacteria driven, not the yeast, because the volume of acidity and volume of esters and range of esters being produced by the bacteria is orders of magnitude different to the what you're going to get in a pitched yeast. And that's where you're going to get, I mean, we would typically have ester count 600 to 900 on our, I mean, they can go to 2000. We don't like that. But yeah. And again, no dunder, no, I mean, obviously dunder and things like cane vinegar are supercharging your acidity, but we prefer this kind of more natural, more symbiotic development. And it can be managed. It's without, you know, I can't give away secrets, but it is quite amusing how we manage these natural fermentations. There's a lot of nudging and shoving, and yeah, there's a lot without adding anything. But yeah, and as I say, the wonderful thing about it is you really then understand this word terroir. You get it big time, because the rum you make in February is different from the rum you make in March. It's different from the rum you make in April. And I was having a chat with, with Gregory from Nissan Distillery, and we both agreed April made the best rum.
Wow. I can move on. Yeah, I've got a question for you. We're moving on from fermentation to the next stage of the business, the distillation. I'm really interested to hear a bit more about the vacuum still that you've got there, the column still. I'm an ex-biochemist. I was a biochemistry student at university. I didn't go on with it, but these vacuum stills are such a sexy thing to me. Like, I don't understand why the distilling world isn't embracing them more. They seem to have so many advantages, less power to heat up, all those sorts of, things.
Again, it's like, it's about, you know, people don't buy, especially old distillers, don't buy stills, new stills every day. And of course, we have a very conservative industry. So there is a tendency that even when that sort of day comes along once every 20 or 25 years, time to buy a new still or add a still, it's like build it exactly like the old one and you can understand that. So you need to have either you've jumped that technological gap already, and so they are distillers in New World distillers, modern day distillers that do have vacuum stills. Some of them, unfortunately, making, you know, essentially very, very light spirit. I don't know of, I can't think of any who basically have the simple twin column design that we run on the vacuum, but so ours are a little different. But yeah, you do have the kind of have that odd scenario that drops up in our case, comes up in our case where we, you know, as they say, put in a new still at four square. And again, this is where my youthful stupidity probably came in and thought, yes, vacuum sounds really cool. Let's do it. And it was curious because, you know, we would taste distillates, obviously, at the time. And there was always a little sort of burnt sugarcane element. And we sort of had to feel, well, you know, we're going to give that up. Is that a good or a bad thing? And I think, looking back, it was a very good thing. But yeah, so we put in our twin column still, the mash column or analyzer column runs on the vacuum. And the rectifier runs under pressure. So it's a lovely double effect. We feed the steam into the rectifier, and the vapor from the rectifier heats the mash column. And then condense them back into reflux. There are some fundamental changes that you have to make compared to the traditional coffee still. So in a traditional coffee still, you drive the heat in the mash column, and the vapor from the mash column is fed to heat the rectifier. You can't do that in a vacuum still because you can't have vapor coming off the top of the mash column. You've got to condense everything from the mash column back into a liquid before you feed it into the second column and then kind of restrip it again. So our second column has both another strip and another rectifying section. So there are a few little quirks, but we have always found it fantastic because you know, scaling, which is something that got sort of worse and worse over the years because of higher presence of ash in modern day molasses, our mash column has never scaled ever. We only ever put a hose to clean it. It's never needed a acid clean or anything of the kind. But yeah, the rum, you just lack some of the negative flavor that you can get from too much heat. And then, so what we've done, we have a column still and two pot stills, and one of our pot stills is traditional atmospheric, but our newer pot still is also vacuum. And that one, I'm absolutely certain there's the only vacuum double retort still in the world. In fact, I would say it's the only vacuum traditional still design adapted to vacuum, which is the other point I would make in terms of why don't you see more vacuum. It's very hard to retrofit it. It's impossible to sort of retrofit a pot still to vacuum. You really have to build it from the ground up. And so when we did that pot still, we built it from the ground up to be vacuum. We weren't necessarily going to do vacuum. We sort of, when we were building that still, we were thinking that's something we'll figure out later on. But then from the time we commissioned it, we decided to go for it, and we went. And so we pull a vacuum on all the pot and the two retorts. And so then that becomes really fun because all your intuitions of the normal still go completely out the window, because in a normal double retort, you know, you're reading your pressure on your pot, and you're reading your pressure on your two retorts, and you want a nice successive pressure fall. Well, a vacuum, you have to do that, but backwards, because they're all on the vacuum, all three vessels. So, well, it's not a question of...
Is it almost like an opposite way of thinking of distilling?
Yeah, it suddenly you don't even think about it anymore at all. It's very bizarre. Awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. Interesting.
All right, let's move on to wood.
Wood.
You want to talk about wood? Ask a question about wood.
I would just add one thing with vacuum as well. We obviously discover with the pot still, again, very a lot of energy savings and a lot of benefits. One of the things I noticed
negatives.
One of the things I noticed immediately with the vacuum still, and I tell this story because we saw it in the beginning, and I just assumed it was a transient. It was just because we started, but the rum tastes rested compared to the other one. So it's like if you took the regular rum and rested it for about 3 months.
Difference. Is there any big negatives from the vacuum still as far as flavors and taste? I haven't found any in yours either, Richard.
I would say that the one negative is that when the normal if you have a you have to pump your product out. So the normal still, you're just relying on, there's no pump at the end. You condense your liquid in the end and it falls out from gravity. So, if you have any kind of failure, a steam failure or everything, it's, less of a catastrophe with the conventional atmospheric still. With a vacuum still, we have to actually pump our spirit out. So obviously if we get any kind of failure, electrical failure or steam failure, then it's a little more of a not disaster, but a little more complicated. And of course, if your pump, pulling the vacuum or the pumping the rum out, fail at any time in the process. So it's a process that has a little more vulnerability. Not that pumps fail very often, but obviously there is a little more vulnerability than in a classic pot still distillation.
Thank you. Yep.
All right, Todd's got a question. He's not to start.
Shut up long enough when we don't.
We'll get there.
So is there any limitations to the sort of wood that you use in Barbados, or are you sort of free to trial all sorts of different barrel types?
Yeah, so, I'm very conservative in what I choose. One of the things... the way I like to explain it is rum is a lot like Scotch whiskey in the sense of not having a local cooperage, local forest. So it's very much like Scotch whiskey in the sense of using refill wood. So this is a contrast, obviously, to, Kentucky bourbon using local American oak or cognac using French oak. We have a long tradition, obviously, of... refill cask coming in, but we also have a very long tradition of using American white oak. I joke we used we've been using American white oak for 200 years before bourbon, so I often joke that they shouldn't be called ex-bourbon cask, they should be called ex-rum cask. So in the West Indies we would import American white oak staves, and of course, we would white oak staves and codfish, and we'd ship back sugar, molasses, and rum. But every plantation had a cooperage. The staves would be imported, and in the early days, everything went in a barrel. We would import actually white oak and red oak, but you'd use white oak only with spirits. And in fact, it became very selective as to what oak was used for keeping spirits. So as I say, today backbone of what we do is ex-bourbon cask, which is American white oak, but that's a long, long tradition that predates bourbon of using white oak. But again, to the extent like Scotch whiskey, we use refill barrels. We use a lot of the core of what we do are ex-bourbon, sherry, and Madeira. And again, that's just because of a long history, Madeira in particular. If you came to Barbados in the 18th century, early 19th century, and you visited a wealthy planter's home, you would have been almost certainly served Madeira. Madeira was the principal drink pretty well in the New World, in American colonies. Madeira was huge. Was killed off by phylloxera. I mean, it's sad today. You struggle to find a bottle of Madeira in Barbados today, but that was the drink. If you look back in ads in 18th and 19th century newspapers, and merchants who were importing, Madeira was always the headline. New Madeira, you know, pipes arrived. Madeira was by far and away dominant. So that's why we do what we do, which is we age American white oak, ex-bourbon, and we also bring a lot of, as I say, they're our core, our backbone, sherry and Madeira. But then we also bring, you know, from time to time, many different casks. But in terms of what I choose, the general principle, as I say, I'm very conservative. We go with very recognized denominations. And I generally go with primary casks. So in other words, I'm going for a denomination that is sourcing their casks as a primary cask. There are exceptions to this, Calvados being a notable one. So we tend to avoid, as I say, anything kind of gimmicky. We would never, you know, I would never use a tequila cask. Nothing against tequila, but it's not a primary cask. I would never use a Scotch whiskey cask. Nothing against Scotch whiskey. It's not a primary cask. I'm searching out the cask for the quality of the wood. So the tradition of the denomination is very important. As I say, I'm not looking for gimmicks. I'm not looking for flavoring, because when we buy casks, we don't do finishes. We use casks for a long time, and we refill them as well. So a lot of our rums that we produce are, you know, produced from refill sherry casks. So they're not, you know, it's not that the rum has gone into them when they've just been emptied of sherry. The rum has gone in them when they've just been emptied of rum. Because, you know, I have sherry casks that are decades old. Because again, as I say, we're looking for the quality of the cask. So yeah, as you say, I describe my, even though I do use a lot of pretty wide range, I would describe myself as being very conservative, sticking with very proven domains, and very cautious on that.
Can I just ask, it sounds to me like you, as far as your cask go, you're looking for the subtractive qualities of the cask more than the additive qualities of what they can do to the base spirit that goes in them. You're looking for
I would still describe them as subtractive, as additive. I would describe subtractive more of what we get with the bourbon cask. So when we get the, you know, the deeply charred bourbon cask has not had a lot of years of use, that's where that charcoal layer does its job of subtractive. But otherwise than that, certainly when I buy an older cask, or we use a refill cask, so we do a lot of double maturations. And so, in, you know, sort of classic scenario, Foursquare will be a 3, 4, or 5 year old rum, then going into a very old sherry or port or Madeira cask. So that cask is not going to have a lot of subtractive quality. First of all, because they're toasted and they're not charred, I'm gonna rely on the bourbon cask to do the subtractive job. And then in our climate, I'm gonna want that second maturation to be all about oxidation and concentration. And yeah, and sorry, I think we're using the word additive, and depends on the perspective of the spirit. So I'm thinking from the perspective of the spirit. So the wood is adding to the spirit. And when I think of subtractive, I'm thinking of where the wood takes out from the spirit. So I'm thinking of, you know, the charred cask taking out some sulfury compounds. So in my second maturation, I think my spirit has already been, you know, cleaned up. So I'm not looking for the cask to do that. So yes, I'm still additive, but I think the point is that when I use like an old refill sherry cask, I still see the cask as very additive. But it's not necessarily additive in the sense of a finish, where someone is using a cask of a finish and they want that influence of that sort of sherry. You know, one of the most bizarre words I hear in the spirits world, and sometimes contradictory, is this concept of a neutral cask. I've never found such a thing. And I say contradictory because I say it's contradictory because I sort of get told on one hand, you can't age rum for a very long time. Oh, no, you can't age a 20-year-old rum because you'll get really nasty and woody. And then at the same time, someone says to me, well, yeah, but after 10 or 12 years, the cask is neutral. Well, which the hell is it? One moment, the cask is deadly for 20 years. And the next moment, the cask is no good after 10 or 12. So, you know, make up your mind.
I've got a question mainly about kind of like industry sway and where you see rum is as its entire category. So I do believe that most years is very good for Foursquare, but 2023 was quite significant, where also rum as a genre took out the champion kind of producer award as a whole, which was the first time that rum had ever done that. Did you see any kind of industry trend follow from that? And also, if you guys celebrated with Foursquare, what did you guys do to celebrate?
So I think you're referring to 2023 when I got named IWC industry champion, I think, which was the first time.
Yeah, I'm referring to that.
I'm sure we celebrated. And I'm sure I celebrated with a nice rum and a very, very large cigar.
How long? Can you show us the hands?
At least a double Corona.
Love it. But in terms of like rum in the industry, I'm not really too familiar of how it is in Barbados, where it's from an outside perspective looking in, it's all about rum there. Is there other spirits that rum competes with, especially on not just the local stage, but the global stage? And did you see kind of like a boost of attention or clout?
Yeah, so that brings you sort of back to part of your very first question. Yeah, I mean, obviously rum is a very dominant part of our culture. It's everywhere. It's in every kind of social occasion. It's so integral to the culture. Of course, one of the things about us has become much more economically successful, and with economic success, people then want to try different things and, you know, aspire to imported things. So you know, one of the signs of our success, of course, in Barbados is that people, you know, drink other things. So we have more competition, if you like, from rum in rum from other spirits than say we would have had 20, 30, 40 years ago. And that's natural. But one of the things that I'm very proud of is that, you know, the Foursquare releases, like our vintages there, our special releases, the highest per capita purchaser of these rums is Barbados. So Barbados gets by far and away the largest per capita allocation. Now, I'm being slightly disingenuous because some countries could probably buy a lot more than I restrict them. But I'm still quite proud that in Barbados we have a strong rum community. So we have rum drink right across the board, but we do have a strong rum community that appreciates these rums. And as I say, obviously that's very important. We don't want to be just creating the rums which are not familiar in Barbados just because we're chasing, you know, more expensive and more aspirational and wealthier. Obviously that's one of the reasons why we export. We're chasing bigger markets, more, you know, wealthier clientele. But I'm very proud in Barbados. We, you know, built up a community there. Again, in numbers, obviously it's small because, you know, we're a small island. But per capita wise, it's very impressive. And it's actually been one of the most satisfying things to me, which is kind of ironic because when you, as a rum producer in Barbados, and we sort of first made the decision to exports, and you know, our early days of sort of sending a rum off to a competition over and away, which is probably a feeling you guys in Australia would also get, you know, sending a wine or a rum or whatever over to Europe and sort of having this kind of sort of independent approval was very important. But unexpectedly I ended up getting a lot more satisfaction out of the fact that some of our rums in Barbados are highly sought after, and we have a allocation which sells out extremely rapidly. And so because, as I say, me growing up, you know, the 70s and 80s were not the greatest time for rum. You go back, you know, you can go back in the 30s and 40s and 50s and find wonderful old rums. The 70s and 80s seems to be a pretty dreadful time for spirits. Generally, very hard to find very old rums back then. So growing up, we didn't really have a good appreciation or a good following of very old rums. And so to see that today and for myself to be part of that, it's been very satisfying.
Well, we've got a series of questions on the board by the looks of it. So should we put them up, Luke? And do you want to read them out? I'll get Steve McGarry's question as well and add to the list.
Can you read that part?
So how would you describe the blending process?
A little of this and a little of that. There's two elements there. There's two aspects, not elements there. You know, there's the blending process where you are producing, you know, a brand, a consistent product, you know, master blender who is responsible for banging out, making sure his Johnny Walker Black is absolutely perfect. And then there's when you're creating something. And so the one that's really tough is the one where you're trying to produce a consistent product. And I have a team for that. And they're very good at that. And I think sometimes that doesn't maybe get the attention it deserves, and there's a little more attention on the creative side. And the creative side is really, honestly, we just do what we like. We don't, you know, the idea that, you know, I've blended something and it's, you know, there's no objectively true way to blend any particular set of spirits. There's no holy grail you're chasing. You blend, you put together what you like. Well, that's what I do, is, you know, it's what we do. So, you know, I could give everyone at this table two or three components and everyone will put them together differently. And there's none wrong. It's going to be your style. And if you carry them out to an audience, it's going to be whichever audience aligns with your own personal style that's going to sort of win the popularity contest. So if there's more who like your style in the audience, well, then you'll come out as the best blender. But it doesn't mean you're the best blender. It just, it's about, you know, the style. So maybe that comes back a little bit to the point. I would say that one of the challenges that we have at Foursquare is, or one of the challenges I see of having is, you know, is to keep within your style. So I got my, you know, that earlier question about the Barbados style, and that's very important to me. It's very important when you taste a Foursquare rum, you recognize the Barbados style, you recognize the Foursquare style. I could just make something very different every day for no particular reason, and I don't want to do that. I want to make something very recognizable. You know, we did this special release. I don't know if you heard about it, but we did this special release called Chipolenton. And it was a bottle of Nisson, a bottle of Foursquare, and a bottle of Hamden, all on age rums. And the idea was to show these three distillers from these three islands, all using the same raw material, sugarcane, and coming out with three very, very, you know, diverse rums. But the most important thing for me was, even though you might be drinking a Foursquare 2010, and this is a on age 100%, you know, on age 100% pot still rum, I still wanted you to taste that rum and think, yes, this is Foursquare.
You want that? Yeah. All right, so Steve McGarry has a couple of questions, some really good ones. So,
yes, I know.
Who do you consider, who do you consider as influencers, mentors in your journey and your success?
So that's a good question. When I was very young, we employed blenders then, and so much of my early education was the blenders that worked in, you know, we were a blending company that worked with us. So that was sort of my real green introduction rum. I've had a lot of support from the outside, which has been very influential, because you say, well, why from the outside? Because of course we are always aspiring to take rum outside of Barbados and sort of, you know, conquer the world. So one of the, you know, we mentioned wet wood earlier, and the person who gave me the great guidance in wood was, you probably would have heard his name, is Jim Swan, a very famous Scotch whiskey guy. His then partner at the time, Harry Rifkin, is still a friend of mine. He's a chemist in Scotland, so he's also a good influence. You know, there are early even writers like Dave Broom, journalist, but comes out, brings a, you know, huge loads of whiskey knowledge, comes, tasted rums, you know, and these are people not necessarily giving you technical help, but they're helping to inspire you, and they're helping to guide you, and they're help, you know, and that in that way they indirectly influence you. You know, someone like Dave comes out of the Barbados and he's recognized as a whiskey guru, and he says, right, I think you've done a very good job on the wood on this rum. It does have an impact. So it's many people over the years. I mentioned Gregory a couple of times. Gregory Bernard Nisson, that's a distillery which I sort of look on with great admiration. I love everything and how they do it. Their rums are fantastic. You visit his distillery, it's just how a distillery should be kept. It's clean, it's, you know, it's just precise. It's everything about it. He's great. Over on the, you know, on the blending side, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be good friends with Joy Spence from Appleton. And Joy is just very sort of no-nonsense, very skilled, very technical person. And so she's, you know, she's been a good, actually mostly just social, but she's a good influence. I mean, wow, over the years, so many people. I mean, obviously Hamden Distillery, I'm very close to the family and own Hamden Distillery. I've been there, you know, very sort of inspired by everything goes on there. So I think it's a mix of actually people and places, because you never stop learning. Never stop learning, you know.
Yeah. All right. So Matt Hobson, so from Rum World Australia, would love to know more about the Veritas. Why and why with Hampton?
So I mentioned... I mentioned Triple Entente, and the reason we got together with that, Nissan, Hamden and us, is we're the three family-owned distilleries. So there's very few of us in the region, family-owned distilleries that export. And so we keep a very close relationship. We speak to each other a lot and support each other a lot. And Veritas was born out of a wonderful weekend I spent at Hamden. We stayed in a great house with the Hussey family that own Hamden. And we had this wonderful weekend, and we were just, you know, it's just one of these weekends lost away in rum and food and everything else. And we just came up with the idea at that time that we should do something together. And so that was really the idea, was to, as you say, create a white rum. We sort of felt that there were mostly out there very light white rums, or there were some very spectacular but very intense white rums. And we just thought, why don't we put something together? We want to work together as two family distilleries. Let's put something together that we think will be very good, and sort of swap out, give you the kind of flexibility the bartenders want with a lighter spirit, but still have a little bit more rum in it. So, but yeah, it was just born out of, you know, us family distilleries wanting to work together, and same concept with Triple Entente. Triple Natal is not a blend. We put three bottles in a package, but it's the same principle of us. To say, because we are very much a dying breed, family owned distilleries in the region, so we like to work together.
Friends in collaboration. Okay, I'm going to ask this question from Steve, and I'm going to add to it myself. So the question is, thoughts on Australian rum opportunity in the global market? And I know there's a lot of people that would love to hear your thoughts on it, but I just want to add something to that. So I'd say in the last 4 years, there's been a real growth in rum, new rum distilleries, 4 or 5 years, would you say, in Australia?
I would say within like the 4 to 3 years, like a lot of people, like a bigger influx of people coming into to dabble in rum and even like, you know, have it be their champion spirit, which is really,
yeah,
really cool.
Coming into the industry, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like we don't really have like what our country is really specialized in spirit wise. So it's kind of like going head to head in like a whole lot of avenues. So it's really kind of interesting to see a lot of people get into it, and especially within the last, I would say, like probably 4 to 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah, 4 to 5 years. Yeah. So what we're seeing is a lot of new distilleries and all creating different styles of their rum. And we've got them up in Queensland, we've got them down in Victoria, WA, they're all around Australia. So there is no definitive Australian style. And I guess my question to add to it, thoughts on Australian rum opportunity in a global market, does that present challenges in the sense that there is no unique Australian flavour profile?
Well, I would say yes. And don't get me wrong, if you look at somewhere like Jamaica, it's a great example of this. Jamaica has all distilleries making their own style. I mean, you know, a Worthy Park tastes different to an Appleton, tastes different to a Hamden. The spectacularly wonderful thing about Jamaica rum, though, is I could give you any one of their rums and you recognize it as Jamaica rum. So it's quite possible to be all wonderfully diverse and making what you want. But it's something very, very special to have a common thread. So my tentative answer would be yes. Having said that, Australia has credibility in the rum world. You're a sugarcane producer. You have a history of rum production. So I think you do have a great opportunity. But yeah, you know, a good friend of mine once described rum as a little bit akin to wine in the sense that it comes, in other words, the country where it comes from says a lot about it in terms of categorizing. So, you know, if I speak about an Australian wine or I speak about a French wine, immediately you saying the words of the country, it tells me something about it. And rum's like that. If I tell you, you know, Puerto Rican rum, I tell you Jamaica rum, I tell you Martinique rum, you immediately know something about that rum. And I think that's what you would want to achieve. And it doesn't mean you're standardizing or you have a common. That's the hard part, which is, again, what I told you with Foursquare. We can make different rums. The hard part is keeping their identity. And that's not easy. So again, look at Barbados. We have very different distilleries. You know, I'm using juice. Mount Gay is using estate molasses. Nicholas is using syrup. You know, we're all very diverse. You know, there are obviously similarities because we're Barbados. So we both using, you know, we're all using pot stills. But again, you can identify the Barbados style, or you can feel that all of our rums are within that style. But we're not all making the same thing, far, far from. So I would say that's, yeah, I mean, Australia in the rum world is an opportunity for you to leverage, because Australia has credibility, it has provenance, it's a sugarcane growing country, it has a history of rum making. It's there to be grabbed. But yeah, if you're all going in many different directions, can be a challenge, because you do want to have, you do want that when somebody says that word. I mean, take Australian wine, which of course is fantastic, and I love Australian wine, but that's just it. When you say Australian wine, I get connotations immediately.
Yeah, we've actually got the same challenges in whiskey world as well.
Can I expand a bit further on what you've been talking about? Because I think the natural progression of this conversation, Richard, is what you've championed for Barbados rums is the GI, the geographical indicator. So I want to ask, in your opinion, should all countries be fighting for a GI of their own? Secondary, there's a three-part question, so I'll remind you later if you ask. But why was it necessary for you to fight so hard for it, for Barbados GI? And thirdly, what were the roadblocks you came across in this quest for the GI for Barbados?
Well, so a GI, basically, you know, the concept of protecting provenance is very old. And the GI legislation is the modern framework that has been created for it and made it much easier. So if you look at something like Scotch whiskey, they would go all around the world and use whatever legal tools they had to protect Scotch whiskey. And once you have GI legislation in your country, it gives you the ability to register in your own products and for export products to ready market. It's the framework in which the protection takes place. The protection is relevant, and Australia and US are very notorious for not being big fans of protecting provenance. And then Australia, after it developed its wine industry, decided that protecting provenance is a very good idea. Really, it's a scenario where if you create something of value that can be on a reputation, and that's vulnerable to exploitation, that's where a GI is relevant. So what's happened in a place like Barbados is we've developed a great reputation. But it's a very expensive place to produce. It's one of the, you know, no one would choose to put a rum distillery in Barbados based on cost. So anytime you have a scenario like that, you have a scenario ripe for exploitation. And by exploitation, I mean a bottle that says Barbados rum, but it's 10 or 20% Barbados rum, and the rest of it's coming from Guatemala or Venezuela or Cuba or wherever is the cheapest source. And, you know, the same, you know, the Scotch whiskey has the same sort of fight. We've created this valuable thing called Scotch whiskey, and we need to make sure that, a bottle of Scotch whiskey doesn't contain 80 or 90% Indian rum. Of course, now Indian whiskey has really improved it. Obviously, its reputation, and there's genuine Indian whiskey, but back in the day, sort of flavor neutral alcohol. So that's your framework, because unknown to most people, generalized trade agreements don't necessarily protect origins in the way we think. And I'll give you an example of that to what I mean. Trade agreements are complex, and they'll have things like value-added accumulation rules. And these things make perfect sense. Say, for example, in Australia, you're making cars. You still make cars in Australia? Once, but then you made cars in Australia.
We don't make any more cars. Don't mention the cars.
Very famous cars. Okay, so pretend you're still making cars in Australia, and you strike a trade deal with Europe to ship your cars tariff-free, part of your free trade agreement. But of course, every single component of your car doesn't come from Australia. You might be assembling them there, but you're importing some, you know, steel, maybe you're importing the engines, maybe you're, and so trade agreements will have things like value added and accumulation rules to work out and define, well, is that product a genuine Australian product? And so when you have these rules applied across the board, they can capture some things that we would find horrific. So in theory, I could in Barbados import some cheaper rum, blend it with Barbados rum, and export it with a CARICOM, part of our economic region, certificate of origin, as long as I've met the value-added rules under our EPA agreement with the European Union. When I ship this tank of Barbados rum that's already blended, it could arrive in the EU and it will go on to the EU tariff agreement, or EPA, our European Partnership Agreement, and in goes this tank of rum. And then it may be blended with other things. And under EU spirit rules, as long as I, the producer of this derived product from imported, feel that Barbados is essential part of its characteristics, I can write the word Barbados on it. You, the consumer, are very naive and believe that that product that says Barbados rum must have been wholly made by Barbadians in Barbados, and you would be wrong. Of course, none of this is relevant if the product is cheap. But if an origin is valuable, it becomes attractive to do these things, or more attractive to pick certain origins. And you can see, I can give you the textbook example of Japanese whiskey. So the Japanese distillers of, you know, once upon a time, Japanese whiskey was, you know, the sort of low-end stuff drunk in Japan. And very brilliant Japanese distillers have done a wonderful reputation of wonderful job of developing a reputation of Japanese whiskey. But what we saw was more and more Japanese whiskey being exported. And we saw remarkable amounts of Canadian whiskey being exported in bulk to Japan. And no corresponding increase in Canadian whiskey brand sales. So today, you have Japanese whiskey still in Canada. Because there's no rules protecting. And, you know, in Europe, you can find things like Colombian rum, or still in Colombia. You can find all these things. So none of that matters if your product's cheap. I mean, Bacardi has sourced multiple places over the years. Bacardi has created a brand almost sort of independent of its origin. It speaks of its Cuban origin, so it doesn't speak about it, but it's, you know, it's sourced. I mean, we used to ship huge amounts of rum, used to go from Trinidad to Bacardi in Europe. So, but if you have distillers like myself and Foursquare, I mean, and Mount Gay, myself and Mount Gay, sorry, too early in the morning. It's now catching up with me. And we're working very hard on developing the reputation and provenance of Barbados rum. And we have a level playing field for ourselves in the sense that we're 100% producing here. Our costs are identical. All our inputs here are the same costs, everything. And so we're going out there, and when you see a bottle of Mount Gay or a bottle of Foursquare and you see the words Barbados rum, it means, you know, 100% Barbados rum right from fermentation to the filling of that bottle, and all of the costs associated with that. That's why we then have to fight very hard, because at the same time we build a reputation up, is the exact same time we're creating the opportunity for exploitation. And then, of course, you know, hand in hand with the sort of exploited techniques, because I'm sure if someone would say, well, hang on a minute, but if you dilute it with Guatemala rum, it wouldn't be very good. Well, yeah, well, that's where tricks of the trade like sugar and oak flavoring and caramel and all these other tricks of the trade come in. And so you can very easily create a product where you're working off the reputation of the hardworking, genuine people, and you're selling the masses the sugared shit. And then ultimately what you do in the long term is you will destroy the higher end guys. If you let, because that exploitation will spread like a cancer in your long term. So, you know, does every product need a GI? Not necessarily. Although it is a very good advice to say, get a GI before you need it. It's very good advice. And a GI should not be confused with the AOC. And this is one of the tricks of the trade to sort of, you know, to confuse the two. An AOC is a much greater level of protection. And that's where you're saying that not only am I protecting where the product comes from, because that's all that Barbados GI does. It doesn't tell you how to make rum. It just says it's got to come from Barbados. So it's got to be fermented in Barbados, distilled in Barbados, aged in Barbados, bottled in Barbados. Got to come from Barbados. But if you look something like the Martinique AOC, it goes a step further. Because in that case, they don't just want to protect that the rum comes from Martinique. They actually want to protect this style, this specific style of rum making. So, for example, in Martinique, you have a tasting panel. You could follow all the methods, but if the panel says this is not up to scratch, you can't sell this Martinique rum, because they are going that step further. So you know, they prescribe a limitation on the methods, raw material you can use. So in Barbados, you know, we have pot stills, column stills, we have rum from molasses, rum from juice, rum from syrup, we have short fermentation, long fermentation, added yeast fermentation, natural fermentation. We have a wide diversity. So the GI doesn't address restricting anything like that. What it does do is say it's got to take place in Barbados.
That's a complicated, situation. Actually, just bring up
And that's one of the challenges. We're talking about very dry and boring stuff, trade deals and protection. It's very dry, very boring, and it's very easy to spin negatively. So if I'm trying to protect Barbados rum, it's very easy to spin it negatively. Oh, you want to standardize or restrict or constrain, and that's all bullshit. Easily demonstrated bullshit.
Well, Matt Hobson's got a question. It'll be the final question. I think we're getting to the end, and what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate this night with the Golden Bippy, as I was talking about earlier on, the new whiskey liqueur, golden syrup, coconut, and oats, and no, I don't work for me.
And they use the word liqueur on the label?
Yeah.
Is there?
Yes, it says Australian whiskey liqueur.
Because I'm always very saddened that I think the word liqueur has sort of gone out of fashion. I just developed a brand for partner. We don't own the brand, but I developed a ginger liqueur. I mean, sort of proudly put a rum ginger liqueur. We very proudly put liqueur on the label, and I'm very. You know, there's nothing wrong with a sweetened product. You just name it right, you know. You want to make a rum, make a rum. You want to make a rum liqueur, make a rum liqueur. Nothing wrong with that. So I'd love to see the word liqueur come back in fashion a bit.
Okay, so the question from Matt is, in 1906, Australia defined rum, whiskey, and brandy, including maturation of wood, for a minimum of 2 years. It is one of the oldest spirit laws in the world. Is such an old law valuable in the modern world?
So that's a very good question. And the motivation at the time for such laws, and that is very old, the three-year law in Scotch whisky didn't come in until 1916. And it was also with rum too. It was all spirits. The motivation, and I assume in Australia it was, but certainly the motivation in the UK, which I'm more familiar with, was this idea that a mature spirit was more healthy, more less damaging. You would be less drunken. It's hilarious, but that was why it came in 1916 during the Great War. And David Lloyd George, Prime Minister at the time, was a very famous teetotaler. He hated the Scotch whisky industry. And he brought in the three-year law, as well as at that time, a restriction to, first it was 43%, and then 40% was defined as 30 degrees below UK proof. All of that was designed with this notion that, this would make people sort of, it would be less hazardous. Of course, this is today we know is nonsense. So the funny thing today, of course, is while it was relaxed in the UK for other spirits, it was relaxed in 1973 for rum. Whiskey sort of famously adopts it as a kind of a quality criterion. Of course, its history had nothing to do with quality. But the very relevance of it, and specifically in the case of somewhere like Australia, who has it, is you have a scenario where you have this West Indian culture of where white rum is a very big part of our culture. And while we don't use words like golden dark, we always use words like white rum. White rum is a very real thing. And so you have this scenario where, you know, Bob, it is one of your oldest, arguably the oldest rum making place in the world, and we make a thing called white rum. But if we export it to Australia, Australia says, no, hang on, sorry, that's not rum. So I'm not going to tell you that we think very highly of that statement. we are very offended. But again, that's where something like a GI comes in. Because I'm not so familiar with Australia's GI legislation. I know they're a little bit late to the game. But in theory, if I come and I register a GI in Australia, and I register a thing called Barbados White Rum, and the registration is accepted, then it's what I define it to be. So Australia could still have a law that says, right, rum is 2 years old, but Barbados White Rum is whatever the technical file that Barbados White Rum is. So that would be one of the motivations as well for having a GI, because it protects the product in your form. But yeah, and that's what we would want. In other words, we are not allowed to export to you a product which has an identity to us as Barbados White Rum, because you say it is not Barbados White Rum. You say it's Barbados Cane Spirit.
Yeah. Crazy situation. All right, we're going to wrap it up, Richard. Thoughts from the room? Any final comments from anyone?
Just thanks for taking the time at 6 o'clock in the morning, Richard. Pretty much.
You're very well.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much again. Congratulations on all your hard work and success. Thank you for taking the time to chat to us and everyone out there who's tuning in and tuning in later. Yeah, you've been a very, very, very big influence on the Australian rum scene so far. So, yeah, it's going to be really exciting.
I have to come back.
Yeah, when are you? That was one of the questions. When are you coming back?
Please bring more.
So that's a good question. You're a bit far. And I'm planning to do New Zealand next February.
I'm in New Zealand next February. Sorry.
So it's going to be, honestly, it'll be impossible to do both. It's a bit sad to come all that way. But last time I came to Australia, I didn't do New Zealand. I need to visit New Zealand. So when I'm going to get to Australia again is a good question, but it is, you can forgive me because it is far.
No,
it's no further away than Barbados is for us, though.
No, and that's very true. That is very true.
All right. Thank you again, Richard. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
It's been an amazing opportunity for us. We really appreciate it. And everyone who's seen it tonight, you know, like us, follow us on Facebook. This is an example of what we do on Aussie Craft Distillers Shooting the Shit. A deep dive, great conversations, and camaraderie. I'm focusing on the light.
And thanks for all the rum, Richard.
Yeah, and if you can increase our allocation just a teeny little bit, we'll be very appreciative.
Bloody hard to find down here.
This is true.
All right.
Thanks.
We'll let you go, Richard. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Run the credits.